Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LPFM 106.1, Portsmouth Community Radio. I'm your host, Steve Diamond, and today is February 18th, 2006. Our focus today is on New Orleans as they begin Mardi Gras events. Here's what's coming up. In our first hour, we'll hear testimony from the International Commission of Inquiry on Crimes Against Humanity committed by the Bush administration, which held a special evidentiary hearing into Hurricane Katrina on October 22nd. In our second hour, we'll hear Lori Berenson's second commentary from prison in Peru, addressing Hurricane Katrina, the war in Iraq, and the American way of life, and an interview from Active Voice Radio of Timothy Naftali about his article appearing just after Katrina on the Department of Homeland Security screw-up. Michael Parenti's historical commentary and labor news will follow, and we'll end with Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. We'll also have music, announcements, and more. First, some news. This is Steve Diamond with the news, beginning close to home, from the Boston Globe on February 10th. Toms of Maine to buy power from Nebraska wind farm. Toms of Maine, the Sanford maker of natural toothpaste and personal care products, has arranged to buy the equivalent of all the electricity used by its manufacturing and shipping building from a Nebraska wind farm. Through a deal brokered by Constellation Energy Group's Constellation New Energy and the nonprofit group Clean Air Cool Planet, Toms this week began paying the Ainsworth Wind Energy Facility for 130,000 kilowatt-hours per month of electricity, which is fed into the national power grid. Financial terms were not disclosed. The 100,000-square-foot Sanford building uses the equivalent power of 260 average-sized homes. And here's a national story that we think will make you feel much safer. From the Cleveland Free Times on February 9th. Homeland Security counters threat from kindergartners. While Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez assures the U.S. Senate that the Bush administration's domestic eavesdropping program is a vital, quote, early warning system for terrorists, another Homeland Security measure strikes in an Ohio elementary school. The kindergarten class at Lakewood, Ohio's Taft Elementary was planning a field trip to NASA Glenn Research Center. It's a popular trip because it's free, and because NASA staff already has age-appropriate tours that fit well with school curriculum. But school principal Margaret Sable says this year's trip for Taft kindergartners had to be canceled due to Homeland Security concerns. Since new security regulations went into effect on May 1, 2005, access to the visitor center is restricted to United States citizens only. Because two kids in the kindergarten class are not U.S. citizens, the teacher had to cancel the trip. It was just a policy that came down from the Homeland Security Department, said Chief Community and Media Relations Officer Linda Dukes Campbell. We are a federal reservation, and we have to work within those ramifications. Meanwhile, from the New York Post on February 14th, port insecurity. Did the feds really want to place the ports of New York and New Jersey in the hands of a Middle Eastern country with ties to the September 11th hijackers? As the Post reported on Sunday, that's what's about to happen now that Dubai Ports World has won control, for $6.8 billion, of British-owned Peninsular and Oriental Steam Navigation Co. The purchase gives Dubai Ports control of six U.S. ports, New York, New Jersey, Miami, Baltimore, Philadelphia, and New Orleans. The deal reportedly was approved by the top-secret U.S. Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, which declared there was no security risk. Dubai Ports is owned by the United Arab Emirates, whose banking system provided most of the cash for the 9/11 hijackers. Indeed, much of the operational planning for the World Trade Center attacks took place inside the United Arab Emirates. And while the Bush administration considers the UAE a major ally in the war against terror, the Treasury Department has been stonewalled by the Emirates in trying to track Osama bin Laden's bank accounts. New York Senator Charles Schumer, for one, thinks this is a case where it's better to be safe than sorry. Noting that the nation's ports, quote, remain top terrorist targets, Schumer says, we should be very careful before we outsource such sensitive homeland security duties. Though no one likes to discuss it publicly, smuggling and weapons of mass destruction likely can be most easily done through the ports. And our next story, published on Sunday, February 12th by the Sunday Telegraph of Britain, U.S. prepares military blitz against Iran's nuclear sites. Strategists at the Pentagon are drawing up plans for devastating bombing raids backed by submarine-launched ballistic missile attacks against Iran's nuclear sites as a, quote, last resort to block Tehran's alleged efforts to develop an atomic bomb. Central Command and Strategic Command planners are identifying targets, assessing weapons loads, and working on logistics for an operation. They are reporting to the office of Donald Rumsfeld, the defense secretary, as America updates plans for an action if the diplomatic offensive fails to thwart the Islamic Republic's alleged nuclear ambitions. Tehran claims that it is developing only a civilian energy program. Tehran has dispersed its nuclear plants, burying some deep underground, and has recently increased its air defenses, but Pentagon planners believe that the raids could seriously set back Iran's nuclear program. The White House says that it wants a diplomatic solution to the standoff, but President George W. Bush has refused to rule out military action and reaffirmed last weekend that Iran's nuclear ambitions, quote, will not be tolerated. Senator John McCain, the Republican frontrunner to succeed Mr. Bush in 2008, said recently, quote, there's only one thing worse than the United States exercising a military option, and that is a nuclear-armed Iran. Senator Joe Lieberman, a Democrat, has made the same case, and Mr. Bush is expected to be faced by the decision within 2 years. By then, Iran will be close to acquiring the knowledge to make an atomic bomb, although the construction will take longer. The president will not want to be seen as leaving the White House, having allowed Iran's ayatollahs to go atomic. And now an article about the U.S. spreading democracy in the Middle East, or something like it. In case you missed this one from the New York Times on February 14th, U.S. and Israelis are said to talk of Hamas ouster. The United States and Israel are discussing ways to destabilize the Palestinian government so that newly elected Hamas officials will fail and elections will be called again, according to Israeli officials and Western diplomats. The intention is to starve the Palestinian Authority of money and international connections to the point where its president, Mahmoud Abbas, is compelled to call a new election. The hope is that Palestinians will be so unhappy with life under Hamas that they will return to office a reformed and chastened Fatah movement. The officials and diplomats, who said this approach was being discussed at the highest levels of the State Department and the Israeli government, spoke on condition of anonymity. They said Hamas will be given a choice: recognize Israel's right to exist, forswear violence, and accept previous Palestinian-Israeli agreements, as called for by the United Nations and the West, or face isolation and collapse. Opinion polls show that Hamas's promise to better the lives of the Palestinian people was the main reason it won. But the United States and Israel say Palestinian life will only get harder if Hamas does not meet those three demands. The officials drafting the plan know that Hamas leaders have repeatedly rejected demands to change and do not expect Hamas to meet them. The strategy has many risks, especially given that Hamas will try to secure needed support from the larger Islamic world, including its allies Syria and Iran, as well as from private donors. It will blame Israel and the United States for its troubles, appeal to the world not to punish the Palestinian people for their free democratic choice, point to the real hardship that a lack of cash will produce, and may very well resort to an open military confrontation with Israel. The destabilization plan centers largely on money. The Palestinian Authority has a monthly cash deficit of some $60 to $70 million after it receives between $50 and $55 million a month from Israel in taxes and custom duties collected by Israeli officials at the borders but owed to the Palestinians. Israel says it will cut off those payments once Hamas takes power and put the money in escrow. On top of that, some of the aid that the Palestinians currently receive will be stopped or reduced by the United States and European Union governments. Israel has other levers on the Palestinian Authority, controlling entrance and exit from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip for people and goods, the number of workers who are allowed into Israel every day, and even the currency used in the Palestinian territories. Israeli military officials have discussed cutting Gaza off completely from the West Bank. They also say they will not allow Hamas members of the Palestinian parliament, some of whom are wanted by Israeli security forces, to travel freely between Gaza and the West Bank. Farhat Assad, a Hamas spokesman, and Nasser Abdeljawad, who won a seat in Salfit, gave the United States, quote, a year or two to come around to the idea of dealing openly with Hamas. Hamas will move on two parallel fronts, Assad said. The first, to reform Palestinian political life, and the second, quote, to break the isolation of our government. If Hamas succeeds on both fronts, he said, we will achieve a great thing for our people, a normal life with security and a state of law where no one can abuse power. Hamas will find the money it needs from the Muslim world, said Mr. Abdeljawad, who spent 12 years in jail and got a PhD while there. Hamas will save money by ending corruption and providing efficiency. Hamas will break the Palestinian dependency on Israel, he said. Mr. Assad laughed and added, quote, first, I thank the United States that they have given us this weapon of democracy, but there is no way to retreat now. It's not possible for the U.S. and the world to turn its back on an elected democracy. And our last news story is a first-person account of a U.S. raid on an Iraqi home. This was printed in The Guardian on Wednesday, January 11th, and written by Ali Fadil. The Night the Americans Came. Last weekend, an American Special Task Force unit raided my house. It was precisely the kind of terrifying experience I have had described to me over and over again by Iraqis I have interviewed in the past 2.5 years. My wife, Zina, described it as like something out of a Hollywood action movie. It began at 12:30 on Saturday when explosives blew apart the 3 entrances to my house. We thought we had been caught in a bombing, but then a rifle sneaked round my bedroom door and shot a couple of bullets blindly. Suddenly, our room was filled with the wild sounds of U.S. soldiers. My 3-year-old daughter, Sarah, woke to this nightmare. She pushed herself onto me and shouted, "Daddy, Americans, they will take you. No, no, not like this, Daddy." She tried to say something to one of the soldiers, but her tears stopped her from speaking. Instead of blaming the soldier, I could see she was blaming me. I tried to calm her down, but as I did so, the soldier threw me to the ground and tied me. They took me downstairs and made me sit in the living room while they smashed every piece of furniture we have. There were about 20 soldiers inside the house and several others on guard on the roof. A blue-eyed captain came to me, holding my handycam camcorder, and questioned me aggressively. "Can you explain to me why you have this footage?" I explained, "These are for a film we are making for Channel 4 dispatches. There is nothing sinister about it." But that was not good enough. He seemed to think he had found very important evidence. Hooded and with my hands tied, I was taken to an armored vehicle. I was then driven to an unknown destination. I spent the entire journey thinking back on what had happened in the past 2 years of the occupation. I have so often heard of such things happening to others, but now I was experiencing it myself, and I too could feel the shame and humiliation. It is this kind of disrespect for the privacy of the home that tribal people regard as a terrible humiliation, which Sunnis in the west of Iraq see as legitimizing resistance. When the journey eventually ended, I found myself in a small room, 2 meters square, with wooden walls, a refrigerator, and an oval table in the middle. Soon, 2 men came in, civilians, wearing vests. They said, "Do you know why you are here, Mr. Fadhil?" I replied, "To be interrogated?" With a broad smile, one of them said, "No, there was a mistake in the address, and we apologize for the damage." So that's it. They blew 3 doors apart with explosives, smashed the house windows, trashed all our furniture, damaged the car, risked our lives by shooting inside rooms aimlessly, hooded me and took me from my family who didn't know if they would ever see me again, and then, with a smile, they dismissed it as a small mistake. So is this intimidation or just a typical piece of bungled repression? I don't know and cannot tell, though I have yet to have my tapes returned. I do know, however, the effect it has had on my daughter. Sarah hates all soldiers and calls them Americans even if they are Iraqis. There is no way she will change her mind about them after that nightmare. There are many Iraqis, Iraqis who welcomed the fall of Saddam, who feel exactly the same way. Next, we'll hear from the International Commission of Inquiry on Crimes Against Humanity committed by the Bush administration. This event was recorded on Saturday, October 22nd, featuring witnesses from the Gulf Coast. We'll start with Malik Rahim of the Common Ground Collective in New Orleans.
Malik is a veteran of the Black Panther Party in Louisiana and has organized public housing tenants for decades. Malik lives in the Algiers section of New Orleans, and in his own words, "This neighborhood could be sheltering and feeding tens of thousands of displaced people, but we're allowed to help no one. The actions of the authorities are criminal."
First of all, I would like to thank you for allowing us this opportunity to expose the injustice that was allowed to be carried out. On the 28th, and I'm a spiritual person, on the 28th of August, I truly believe that it was the spirit of Emmett Till that turned that hurricane from hitting New Orleans to hitting Mississippi. Mississippi is the state that he died in, that he was murdered in. That's the state that bore the brunt of that hurricane. Not trying to take anywhere from the devastation in Mississippi, but if Katrina would have hit New Orleans, over 100,000 poor and black people would have perished. I make that statement based upon the fact that without hitting us, by New Orleans only being affected by the weakest side of a hurricane, the western side, such devastation occurred. It occurred because of neglect and abandonment. It occurred because we in New Orleans have an administration that had dropped the ball, didn't know what they was doing, by a governor that didn't have a clue, and by a president that just sit back and watch these two fools make this condition exist so that, one, he could play party politics, because they both was Democrats. And he waited all the way until he could assure that when he walked in and when he came in, that it wasn't going to be no other attempt to stop what they have done. America came into New Orleans the government came into New Orleans as an occupying force. And many of us know that when America go, wherever it go as an occupying force, it do not leave. I believe that's the first step of militarization of America. Louisiana is a New Orleans is surrounded by some of the most racist parishes in the United States, or racist counties in the United States. When David Duke ran for governor of the state of Louisiana, he won the white vote in all the surrounding parishes that surround New Orleans. Most of the police in New Orleans, the bottom half is predominantly black, but the top half is predominantly white. Even though, as we say, that we have a black mayor and a so-called black police chief. When Katrina hit, or prior to Katrina hit, many attempts have been made ever since last year, when the Cuban government was able to evacuate 1.5 million people out of harm's way of a Category 5 that was amid a direct hit at Havana. Many of us tried to meet with city administration about establishing such as a similar plan. No one wanted to hear it. We only had, and by the city estimates, it was 120,000 people that had no means of evacuating. The annual income of this 120,000 is roughly around $6,000 to $8,000 a year. So they knew that they did not have the ability or the funds to leave. Government assistance last 2.5 weeks, even though they say it's assistance for a month. This happened on the 29th day of August, so they knew that poor people did not have the resources to survive 5 days. That's on the means to leave. The city did nothing. It said for a mandatory evacuation for those who had means to leave. But with those that, again, that they knew didn't have means to leave, they did nothing. Superdome was only open when it was 12 hours left before the hurricane was supposed to hit. And then they made people stand out in the rain for some up to 5 hours waiting to get in, because they searched every man, woman, and child and all their possessions for weapons before they was allowed into the Superdome. Reason why I'm saying this, because later it was reported that they had groups of armed thugs running through the Superdome, raping women and killing babies. And my response to that to you, if they did, how did they get the arms? Everywhere in that Superdome was police. Hunting season was declared on young black men. From the time that levee broke up until the military came and took over, we had a governor that declared martial law with a shoot to kill orders that only was imposed upon blacks. You had individuals white vigilantes that was given carte blanche to kill whoever they suspected to be a looter. And that's all you had to, the only criteria you had to meet to be a looter is to be black. And in particular, to be a young black male. Nothing was organized. We asked the fire department to organize a rescue effort. They could not do it. The police only concern was basically to beat up or brutalize young black males. We seen guys jump into that water, some using refrigerators, where they tear the top and pull the motor out of the refrigerators and use that as floating devices to rescue people. Seeing the individuals that were shooting in the air just to let helicopters know where they was, but later was accused of shooting at helicopters. In Algiers, we seen bodies of people that was killed that was dumped in front of the city's health clinic and allowed to fester there for over 14 days. And nobody would pick it up until Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! Reported it. Then the next day it was picked up. We seeing young black men that were slaughtered because they said they had guns on I-10. But we seeing white vigilantes that was able to ride through the communities in pickup trucks with guns exposed, and the police literally just drove by them. We was victims of it to the degree that on day three we asked for medical help, and doctors from Atlanta with medical supplies was searched and then turned around. But at the same time, whites who had guns in their possession was allowed in. But the doctors happened to be black, and the ones with guns happened to be white. We saw this. We also know that John, I can't think of John's last name, and Sharif, who worked with Amy Goodman, was told by Jefferson Parish Police that all the niggas in the Ninth Ward should drown because they are nothing but disease. The tragedy that happened could have been avoided. But the three things that caused this tragedy was basically exploitation, corruption, and racism. Yeah, the president waited till the last hour. But he waited till the last hour because by then most of the dastardly deeds was done.
That was Malik Rahim of the Common Ground Collective, speaking at the special evidentiary hearing into Hurricane Katrina. Next, we'll hear from Jeremy Scahill, correspondent for Democracy Now! At the same event.
Just by way of background, I've been a reporter who's traveled in international conflict zones now for, I guess, about 5 or 6 years as the primary thing that I do with my life. I was in Yugoslavia during the U.S.-led NATO bombing in 1999, 78 days with no U.N. authorization when a Democrat was president. I also have been in Iraq many times. I lived there for basically all of 2002 and the beginning part of 2003. And in my reporting from these countries and others, Nigeria as well, I've encountered private security forces. And so I don't come to this with googly eyes at seeing guns or helicopters. In fact, I was traveling in New Orleans with my partner, and if she wasn't there, I don't think I would have really batted an eye at seeing helicopters, men in camouflage, guns, etc. It was primarily through the lens of her reaction to it that I realized how extraordinary it was to see such a scene on U.S. soil that I had seen replicated so many times in so many other countries. I think out of the rubble of New Orleans and other devastated areas, we're seeing a model for disaster profiteering that is emerging. Similar to the war profiteering that we've seen happen in Afghanistan, Iraq, the Balkans, which is an area that's not discussed, although the U.S. has an enormous military presence there, as do private security firms. And out of this rubble, we're getting a glimpse through the window of part of our future in this country, a future that so many people live as their present or have lived as their past. It gives us a window into declarations of martial law, the wiping out of posse comitatus, which prohibits federal forces from operating as domestic law enforcement agents on U.S. soil. You see, the rich and the elite view New Orleans right now as an experiment. Those aren't my words. That's not my term. It's theirs. One of the people who brought in a paramilitary security force to New Orleans is a man by the name of James Reese. James Reese heads one of the most powerful business lobbies in the South. He's an extremely powerful man in New Orleans. He serves in Republican Democrat Mayor Ray Nagin's administration as the head of transportation. James Reese flew in Israeli paramilitaries by helicopter from Texas from a firm called Instinctive Shooting International. I talked with two of these men from Instinctive Shooting International as they guarded the only privately owned street in New Orleans, the Audubon Place housing community, which is where extraordinarily wealthy people live on St. Charles Avenue. One of them bragged of having participated in the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. When I looked on the website of the company, they offer services that will be fulfilled by people who are veterans of the Israeli military forces, and they make a point of emphasizing that some of their men have served in the GSS or the Shin Bet or other Israeli intelligence agencies. And so there were these men from Instinctive Shooting International, Israelis, on the grounds with their M16 slung around their shoulders operating a checkpoint. They were just a few of the hundreds upon hundreds of private security forces that fanned out across New Orleans. In fact, the men from Blackwater beat FEMA to the scene with their Puma helicopter. They deployed some 200 men in New Orleans, and when I encountered them in the French Quarter and asked them, "What is your function here?" they told me that their function was to confront criminals and stop looters. Well, after I initially reported that, the company started to sing a different tune because there were some legal issues that could be raised by such vigilantism. And as I talked to these men from Blackwater, I knew well who they were because it was because of the four Blackwater mercenaries that the U.S. had its supposed justification to slaughter the city of Fallujah, causing tens of thousands of people to flee their homes, outright killing hundreds upon hundreds of others. It was when the four Blackwater mercenaries were killed, two of their bodies hung, their charred corpses. And it was then a revenge attack to wipe out Fallujah that ensued. And seeing them on the streets of New Orleans stunned me. They sped around in an unmarked car, four of them, dressed in all khaki, bulletproof jackets. One of them showed me a Louisiana state law enforcement badge. They said they'd been deputized by the governor of the state of Louisiana. We talked, and two of them said that they had served on the private security details of L. Paul Bremer, the former proconsul of Iraq, the head of the U.S. occupation forces there, as well as John Negroponte. One of them had just gotten back from Iraq 2 weeks before being deployed in New Orleans. He said to me, when they told me New Orleans, I asked them, what country is that in? We then heard one of them talking on the phone to a colleague of his, urging him not to deploy with Blackwater because they were only getting paid $350 a day plus per diem. So I reported, Daniela Crespo and I reported on our interaction with these four men. We stood with them and we watched them clear out an apartment on the corner of Bourbon and St. Peter in the French Quarter, throwing a mattress over a balcony, throwing shoes over a balcony. It was above a bar called 7-Eleven on the corner of Bourbon and St. Peter. We don't know whose apartment they were clearing out, if they had permission to be in there or not. They also took over that bar, 7-Eleven. And as we watched them throwing someone's personal items onto the street to set up their headquarters, one of them slung an American flag over the balcony. Blackwater had set up shop in the French Quarter. And as they did that, members of the 82nd Airborne Division marched in this incredible formation. They're known as one of the most disciplined forces within the U.S. military. And I thought perhaps they were going to be there and say, no, you can't do that, that's someone's private property, but they were saluting the Blackwater guys and standing almost as though they were there to defend the operation of going in and clearing out this apartment. And so as we talked, they said that they'd been deputized, that they were there to stop looting and confront criminals. They drove around in unmarked cars. They carried M16s, each one of them, as well as multiple other weapons strapped to their bodies. They had ammo pouches around them. 2 weeks earlier, they had been in Iraq. In fact, one was talking about how he just wanted to get back to Kirkuk in the north of Iraq because that's where the real action is. Blackwater denied, as did the federal government, that there were any private security forces on federal contract, but indeed it turns out, and they were forced to admit it after we did this report, that they were given the first no-bid contract to do security for the federal government. They were given a $400,000 contract to guard FEMA reconstruction sites. In Louisiana, in the state of Louisiana, before the hurricane hit, there were roughly 70 private security firms registered. Within the first 2 weeks, 30 more registered in the state of Louisiana. Blackwater, as I said, beat FEMA there. Another company that got in there early was DynCorp, which is the Walmart of private security firms. It's a $2 billion corporation. Well, I wrote this up for The Nation magazine, a piece called Blackwater Down. The CEO and president of DynCorp, a man named Stephen Cannon, heads a $2 billion company, and DynCorp has its history in Air America, the CIA airline. You can ask Ray McGovern about it, who's here. Stephen Cannon wrote a letter to the editor of The Nation complaining about my characterization of DynCorp as mercenaries. Mr. Cannon portrayed his organization as the second coming of what most people think is the Red Cross. So I'm responding to that in a forthcoming issue of The Nation, but I just want to tell you a little bit about what I'm going to say to them. This is why I'm concerned about DynCorp deploying on the streets of a U.S. city. In Bosnia, its employees ran a sex trade operation involving girls as young as 12. The head of DynCorp in Bosnia filmed himself raping two women. A lawsuit filed by a whistleblower that the company was forced to settle said, quote, employees and supervisors are engaging in perverse, illegal, and inhumane behavior and were purchasing illegal weapons, women, forged passports, and committing other immoral acts. These men are now on the streets of New Orleans. They've been deputized, they said in this letter, by the sheriff of St. Bernard's Parish. In Haiti recently, they beat journalists because they are the private security thugs for President Boniface Alexander, U.S. puppet. They trained the Haitian police and brought back to prominence members of the Tonton Macoute after Aristide was overthrown originally. There are 10,000 Ecuadorians who have filed a lawsuit against DynCorp because DynCorp is wholly responsible for the crop spraying in Colombia under Plan Colombia. And the crops dusting, the spraying, has gone into Ecuador and has maimed people, caused children to have birth defects. They've hit civilian villages in Ecuador. And this is just two of those scores of companies that have come pouring in to New Orleans. See, what I see happening here right now in New Orleans is that they've taken a very black city, and they've done an effective job of de-blackifying it. And now what are they going to do? The people like James Reese, who I mentioned before, who brought in those Israelis, what's his vision for New Orleans? Well, he told the Wall Street Journal, those who want to see this city rebuilt want to see it done in a completely different way, demographically, geographically, and politically. I'm not just speaking for myself here. The way we've been living is not going to happen or we're out. I saw the community that Mr. Reese lives in. Mr. Reese lives in a humongous house, and his Israeli security guards were bragging about how they're watching his plasma screen TV and sitting in his jacuzzi while they do his security for him. The Housing and Urban Development Secretary Alfonso Jackson said it's not going to be as black as it was for a long time, if ever again. That's the dream of the corporate elite. And what they've done is they've brought in paramilitary private security forces to back up their agenda. See, it's not just about what's happening right now in New Orleans. It's about what happens when 10,000 black people want to return to their neighborhood. Who are they going to be facing down? The same men who shoot people in Afghanistan, Iraq, and the Balkans are now deployed on the streets of an American city by people who have said explicitly, we don't want black or poor people to live here anymore. It's as clear as that. Whether it's the federal government bringing these forces in, or it's James Reese bringing these forces in, or it's a man named F. Patrick Quinn, who I had the dishonor of meeting. F. Patrick Quinn is one of the wealthiest hotel operators in the south of this country. He runs a hotel chain called the Decatur Hotel Chain. Well, I talked to his head of security, his wife, Patrick Quinn. His wife was just elected in a special election to the state house in Louisiana. Her name is Julie Quinn. She's a Republican. They're contributors to George W. Bush. And so he runs a hotel chain called Decatur Hotels. He brings in a private security firm to guard his hotels. Well, his head of security, a man named Michael Montgomery, bragged to me that he had been engaged in a shootout with some people he called some black gangbangers on an overpass in the Ninth Ward. He said, we were driving to go pick up one of Mr. Quinn's associates. One of the first days after they deployed, it was on the second night that they got there. They were on their way. They got caught up or lost. They claimed that they came under fire from an overpass. And I said, well, what did you do? He said, well, I was on the phone with my business partner at the time. I dropped my phone, and we returned fire. He returned fire with an AR-15 rifle and with a Glock 9. And I said, did you kill them? He goes, put it this way. There was a lot of moaning and screaming, and then it stopped. Enough said. And I said, what happened after that? Was there a report filed? He goes, oh, yeah, the army came. And he said, they thought we were the enemy. They surrounded us, but I explained to them that we were security. And then they turned around and they left. And then he said, and then state troopers came, Louisiana state troopers came. And they asked him what had happened. He told them, and then the troopers asked this private security guard who had been brought in from Alabama, how do we get out of New Orleans? Literally directions, how do we get out of here? Because it was chaos. It was like a post-apocalyptic video game at the time. And so this guy shot up people he describes as black gangbangers on an overpass in the Ninth Ward and then left the scene. Two separate agencies had come to the scene and did nothing about it, didn't file a report. They just left. Turns out that this company that this man operates, called BATS, Bodyguard and Tactical Security, didn't register with the state of Louisiana. It was operating illegally, even in Louisiana, which has some of the most outrageous gun laws in the country. So this man was nothing but a cheap, murderous vigilante, if what he's saying is true. But he's in the employ of one of the wealthiest citizens of New Orleans, a man who, the day that this piece came out in the Nation magazine, where his head of security is bragging about shooting up some black gangbangers, is profiled on the front page of the New York Times business sections as a sort of business messiah for the city of New Orleans with his own private security force. You know, of the Dying Corps men who were there, don't take my word for it on how dangerous it is to have these people functioning on the streets of a U.S. city. Take the words of Brigadier General Carl Horst, who's the deputy commander of the 3rd Infantry Division, responsible for security in and around Baghdad. This is what he said about Dying Corps specifically and security companies in Iraq in general. He told this to the Washington Post about a month ago. He said, quote, "These guys run loose in this country," referring to Iraq, "and do stupid stuff. There's no authority over there, so you can't come down on them hard when they escalate force. They shoot people, and someone else has to deal with the aftermath. It happens all over the place." This is a general in the U.S. military talking about a private security company that has now deployed with the authorization. They have been deputized by the chief of police of St. Bernard's Parish. And all of this private security, and I'm going to wrap up here, all of this private security comes in because of the looting. But if you've traveled around in New Orleans, you'll find that even in the Ninth Ward, the place that now has become the symbol of being criminal, you know, in the media, it's the Ninth Ward, it's the feared place. You can see a totally looted, as they put it, Circle K grocery store, a convenience store where all the food and perishable items have been taken out. But you can see an electronics store where nothing has been touched because you can't eat a stereo. And so they inflate the security threat that they faced, and they bring in their Israeli paramilitaries, they bring in their Blackwater mercenaries, they bring in their Dying Corps cops, because they said, oh, we need to protect ourselves, and they'll send the bill to the federal government. But the story no one wants to talk about is that there really wasn't the insecurity that they say there was. There wasn't really the security gap that they say there was. It just became convenient to use that as a rationale, a justification for an agenda that they had planned a long time ago. There's a reason why that particular levee wasn't repaired. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers knew it years ago. They knew it in the mid-90s, and that it was unsafe to continue construction the way that they did, that it needed a radical rehauling of the security of the construction operation, and they did nothing about it. They let it be built in a shabby way. Why? We need to ask ourselves these questions. Cynthia McKinney asked recently, when Dying Corps was up for more contracts to do vaccinations, are we rewarding individuals and companies who traffic in girls and women in this country now? This was just in March that she said that, and she questioned Donald Rumsfeld about it. So my concern isn't only what are we looking at right now. It's when people want to come back in and they want to say, this is my home and it will be again and I want to rebuild it, who are they going to be facing down? Because the reality is there was no Red Cross that I could see when I was there. I saw one FEMA vehicle the entire time that I was there. But I saw every possible form of law enforcement, as they call themselves. Every badge, every gun, every camouflage, every blue. I have photos of Chicago Fire Department looting a bar in the French Quarter. We know there are 13 New Orleans police officers who were engaged in systematic looting. And that's just what's become public. But I haven't seen any real compelling footage that shows there was rampant criminality going on in New Orleans. We heard the testimony of Malik Rahim about a citizen's response to this hurricane. And you don't need to take my word for it. Look at the emails, the 19 pages of emails that were released on Thursday between Marty Bahamonde, who was the only FEMA official on the ground in New Orleans, and Michael Brown. He's saying it has reached a past critical stage. People are dying. They run the risk of starving. And I kid you not, the response from the press secretary for Michael Brown was to come back at him off of her BlackBerry and say, Michael Brown can't just eat in 20 or 30 minutes. The restaurants here are crowded and the wait staff's a little overworked right now. So he needs to go to the restaurant of his choice, and 20 or 30 minutes isn't long enough. That's in response to someone talking about starvation in New Orleans. Now, we talk about criminal neglect here. I've done a lot of reporting on Yugoslavia, and I know, because I've been to his trial, that Slobodan Milosevic is on trial in The Hague right now, and he's being held accountable for the actions of private paramilitary forces operating in a part of Yugoslavia that he was not in control of, and he's being held accountable for rapes, for murders, for political killings, for shooting people in the face. He's being held accountable for private paramilitaries. He's being held accountable for a military force that was not under his direct command structure. Michael Brown was directly under George W. Bush. Directly under George W. Bush. The case for criminal neglect is building here. But it's not just about Michael Brown. It's not just about the Department of Homeland Security. It goes all the way to the top. That's what we've been taught. Those of us who report on international justice, we've been taught about command responsibility. How all of a sudden is it inapplicable in this situation? Of course Bush is responsible for the actions of his underlings. I know I've gone over by a couple of minutes here, and so I just close with this, that we cannot view what has happened and continues to happen and will continue to happen in New Orleans through a narrow lens. We need to view it through the much broader lens, the bigger lens of what's happening in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in the prisons in this country. We've got the hidden hand, the vicious and hidden hand of the free market, backed up by the iron fist of militarism. We see it in Iraq, and now the Mississippi has become the Tigris. Thank you.
That was Jeremy Scahill, correspondent for Democracy Now! Next, we hear from Tanya Jones, filmmaker from New Orleans.
Our next witness is Dr. Tanya Jones. Dr. Jones is an independent filmmaker and a native New Orleans, and she's also a professor at Medgar Evers College. Dr. Jones will speak about conditions and the struggles going on in New Orleans.
Greetings. Thank you all for holding out as you have, and thank you for having me here today. I am a native New Orleanian. My father grew up on St. Anne and Broad in the 6th Ward, and my mom grew up on Galvez Street in the 7th Ward. My family's home of 43 years and a host of aunts, uncles, cousins, and friends' homes were totally destroyed in Hurricane Katrina, post-breaking of the levees. I currently live in Brooklyn, New York, and I was approached by a group of 5 women independent filmmakers who I met at the college about a project to document the story of my family and to examine issues of race and class around Hurricane Katrina and its aftermath. We were all disturbed by the images corporate-controlled media was sharing and were having a hard time delineating between fact and fiction. We decided to make sure that a more realistic picture of the residents' story should and would be told. We were continuously seeing the images of the black people looting, and we're getting different stories from friends and family and people that we knew that hadn't evacuated, and that we knew that this couldn't totally be true, so that we wanted to go and get more stories ourselves. I'm sorry that I don't have any of the footage here today with me, because we did capture some very compelling testimonies and stories of people from the city of New Orleans. You can look for that in the future. So we traveled to New Orleans for about 2 weeks, about the third week in September. And at that time, most of the water had subsided in the city, the lower Ninth Ward, and in the Gentilly area, the eastern New Orleans area. We did numerous interviews with residents, historians, grassroots community activists, emergency responders from the local area and from Cincinnati. We talked to FEMA representatives and National Guardsmen who had just returned from Iraq. We also spent time with Mama D and her grassroots organization, the Soul Patrol, who we heard numerous stories had spent a large amount of time in the community saving thousands of lives. We also visited Malik Rahim's group, Common Ground, and talked to defectors from the Red Cross. Of course, we saw huge amounts of physical devastation. But we were particularly interested in learning more about the levees and talking to people about the levees. One of the levees, the London Avenue Canal, is right behind my parents' home, about 2 blocks away, well, what used to be their home. This levee was built in 2004, or was restored in 2004, just recently. So we had quite a concern that this particular levee had breached, as everyone is speaking about. We went through the city and talked to different people about what they thought about the levees, and I know that Professor or Dr. Bullard spoke earlier about the urban myth of the levees being blown and purposely being destroyed. But there were people that we talked to that stayed and didn't evacuate from the city who said that they did hear explosions, that Katrina had passed through the city, and it was like, if you've ever been through a hurricane, I've lived through many in my life, but that there's a calm part, I guess it's that when the eye is passing through, and there's a calm, and then, you know, you can expect some rain or a little bit more rain to come through. But they said that this happened, but then a little while later, they heard explosions, three explosions, and this was from four different people that we talked to, So we're continuing to investigate this and what we're doing. We think that many people sometimes think this is a far-fetched kind of black nationalist kind of perspective that's being put out there, but we really want to know the truth. We know that this was said in 1965 for Hurricane Betsy, that it was also something that was said in 1927 for a hurricane that happened at that time. I also spent some time with some young men that were affected by the penal system in New Orleans. Similar to Brother Eric that spoke earlier today, they were out, they had been in the city. One of the African-American gentlemen who had lost his son had died in the hurricane. He was sucked down trying to evacuate from a residence where the water was rising really high, and he was with his cousin, and they left their residence, and they left the residence, and the young man was sucked into a manhole. So this young man, sorry, I'm a little full right now because all the stories that I've been hearing today have really touched me. But this man had stayed and did not evacuate from New Orleans, this African-American gentleman. He was out with two other volunteers that had come to help in rebuilding the city. I'm going to just go ahead and read this. They were harassed by the police and falsely accused of crimes they didn't commit. The young men were first accused of looting, but they had nothing on them to be accused of that. One of the young men was a journalist, and he handed them his credentials, and they just pushed him away and told them that he was just a dirty old journalist. Mind you, he had been working all day trying to hang a tarp at an elder's home in the community. Now, one of the gentlemen was African-American, two of them were white, but generally, what we heard from African-American men, that they knew that after curfew, they should not be out because of the way that curfew was being enforced in the city, that it really was not being enforced in a very just manner, that you could go in the French Quarter and drink and stand in front of the police stations and things like that, and nobody was really going to hassle you. And there were different times that you didn't really know what the actual curfew time was in the French Quarter area, but that in other areas of the city, that black men, if they didn't know, and if they did stay out later, then the supposed curfew time, whatever time that was at that time, at sometimes we heard it was 6 o'clock, but then it changed to 8 o'clock, so it was different. But that they knew that they could be picked up possibly, so that a lot of them that were helping Mama D and the Soul Patrol knew that they needed to get home before the supposed curfew time. Okay. These young men were told to lie on their stomachs, guns were put to their heads, they were harassed, and they were told that if they made a sound, they would wind up with a cap in their head. The three cops that stopped them were all white. The African-American male, whose son had just died, was kicked around, and one of the cops took his foot and held it to his neck. They were taken to the makeshift prison facility at the Amtrak station in downtown New Orleans that was being run by the Angola State Penitentiary prison warden and New York City's correction officers. There was no sign of the local sheriff. The outside of the prison was being guarded by National Guardsmen. They were held in the prison for 16 hours and weren't allowed to make any phone calls and were charged with criminal trespassing. They met another young African-American man who was also brought in and taken in for just false arrest. He was driving his father's car and was told that he had been drinking. He doesn't drink. He asked them to take a breath test. They refused to allow him to take a breath test. What was happening, like they said before, was that men were being forced to plead guilty. If they didn't plead guilty, that they were going to be taken to Hunts Correctional Facility, where it could be months before they could await trial. From the stories that the gentlemen were hearing and that they told us, that it was like the city was trying to get a free labor workforce, and that one of the gentlemen said, it looks more like slave labor to me. Another instance was Mama D and several of her Soul Patrol members stayed in the community, and they said that there was no signs of Red Cross help or anything like that, but when Red Cross did do some droppings of food, they dropped a barrel of hard candy to them, and they were very, not surprised, but very disappointed by this whole thing. In Lakeview, we went to the Lakeview area. Lakeview is a predominantly white area in New Orleans, but Lakeview also had a breach in the canal, and it's 80% white. It was quite obvious to us that who was being allowed back into the city. Residents were moving around, assessing their damages and beginning the whole rebuilding process. They were gutting their homes and just moving around in a very free nature. In comparison, residents in the lower Ninth Ward, one of the poorest communities in the city, were still being left clueless to if they would be allowed to their homes, when, and is there a real plan for their return? So I will leave you with those thoughts. In sum, we believe that the Bush administration must be held accountable for the destruction of black neighborhoods and communities and the community of New Orleans, and that we must stop the city from becoming culturally, economically, and socially gentrified and becoming a soulless collection of condos, track home neighborhoods for the rich.
Everybody knew that it could happen. The likelihood was clear, the future was coming. Now it's here. They had to fix the levees, because otherwise they'd break. On one side was the city, above it was the lake. It was in the daily papers, in bold letters was the writ. What would happen when the big one hit? But every year they cut the funding, just a little more, so they could give it to the army. Fight their oil war. National Geographic and the Times-Picayune, they forecast the apocalypse, said it was coming soon. Preparations must be made, they said, now is the time. It was years ago, they shouted, inaction was a crime. They said the dikes must be improved and the wetlands must be saved. But Washington decided instead they should be paved, because malls were more important than people's lives. So put some gold dust in your eyes and hope no storm arrives. New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans. Years and years of warning, no evacuation plan, it was just if the waters rose. Get out if you can. There were no buses, No one chartered any trains. There was no plan to rescue all of those who would remain. All the people with no money, all the people with no wheels, all of those who didn't hotwire one that they could steal. Thousands and thousands of people abandoned by the state, abandoned by their country, just left to meet their fate. New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans. And the people died. Then they died some more. They drowned inside their attics, an army of the poor, an army of the destitute who couldn't get away. And the world will remember these sad and awful days, when people shouted from their houses, dying on their roofs. When people came to find them, they were turned back by the troops. They died there with no water, they died there in the heat. They were shot down by the soldiers for trying to find some food to eat. New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans. Now the city is in ruins, a massive toxic sea scattered through the nation. 500,000 refugees, here we are, in the richest country on the earth, where the color of your skin determines what your life is worth, where oil is the king, where global warming is ignored, where the very end of life is the place we're heading toward, where it's more than just a metaphor, the flooding of the dike. Don't stop this madness, the whole planet will be like New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans.
That was New Orleans by Dave Rovics. To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.